Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Brian Lynn, and Steve Ember. But first, this report from Alice Bryant.
It would be difficult to overstate the importance of nurses. They provide about 90% of all healthcare services worldwide. As important as nurses are, many countries are experiencing a shortage. The World Health Organization has noted the huge need for healthcare workers worldwide, especially nurses and midwives. Even the United States and other English-speaking nations have massive shortages. But no matter what country nurses work in, at some point in their careers, they may be required to communicate in English. The reason is simple. The use of English in medical settings worldwide continues to grow. When you think of nurses, you might imagine hospitals. But nurses work in countless other places, such as health clinics, schools, private homes, and assisted living centers. They work on military bases, in refugee camps, and in disaster situations around the world. There are also many specializations within nursing: surgery, cardiac care, oncology, midwifery, and anesthesia are just a few examples. Throughout their career, nurses may work in one or many specialized areas. Charlotte Wogugu knows all about nursing, having worked in a number of specializations and settings. During her 13 years in healthcare, she has served as a surgical nurse, orthopedic nurse, psychiatric nurse, and global health nurse. She has also taken students overseas for their field experience in global health. A native of Nigeria, Wogugu studied nursing in the U.S. and holds a doctorate degree in public health. She is now Assistant Professor Global Health at the University of Maryland School of Nursing. She joins us by phone to talk about nursing and some of the language challenges and victories that come with the job. Thanks again for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Could you tell us a little bit about what you enjoy most about your work as a nursing professional?
One of the major things that I truly enjoy about nursing is the diversity in the role. The core of what truly drives me is the ability to connect with people, because at the end of the day, I am a carer at heart, and it's still people that make my work valuable. So when I talk about the diversity in the role, it really is centered around connecting with people and how that inspires me to keep going to do what it is I do. So I always look at it from that perspective, whereby what it is I am doing with this individual patient is going to impact the lives of other people, not just that patient, but their family members.
Okay, great. In a typical day on the job, maybe in an interaction between nurse and patient, are there common expressions and terms that they might use?
Absolutely. One of the things that we are doing as nurses is that we are assessing this patient the moment we walk in. And by that, I mean we really are assessing their level of consciousness. We are assessing their pain. So to do that, to be able to assess how alert the patient is, I would ask the patient questions like, can you tell me your name and what is your date of birth? And, of course, I've had patients, many, very many, who may be a bit confused. Maybe they may not be able to tell me their date of birth. So I would further probe and ask questions like, can you tell me what today is or what day of the week it is or who the president is?
So could you give me an example of how a language barrier may impact a nurse's interaction with a patient, or you can talk about with the doctor, other health professionals?
Some nurses, maybe for those from Nigeria, for example, which is where I'm from, when we are speaking to individuals in positions of authority or even to patients that are elderly, we, A, don't call them by name, and B, we would use expressions or phrases such as yes, ma. And for some individuals, they may find that offensive because they don't know what that means. But from a cultural perspective, that is actually a sign of respect. I think that when we have nurses who speak a different language, there are also different terminologies that kind of make it challenging. For example, it wasn't until I came to the United States that I understood that pants were actually underwear. But then there are some biases between the nurse as well as the patient in terms of, you know, the nurse does not have a, quote, American accent, so perhaps they may not be able to provide the quality of the care that I expect.
So how can or do nurses overcome such challenges?
I think that nurses, at least in my experience, have truly done an amazing job with overcoming this. And by this, I mean becoming lifelong learners. I was really open about my own deficits in terms of what I didn't know, what I needed to learn, because that truly is one of the first steps to really be able to make the change or, you know, improve on your own quality as a nurse and your own ability to speak the English language fluently. And for me, also, it is important that I practice. And a lot of nurses will tell you that they do that. I'm a firm believer that it takes a village. So administrators in hospitals also need to take an interest in the nurse workforce and also identify this as, you know, an area of improvement.
That's a great, very thorough answer, and it partially answers my next question. So if someone were interested in the nursing field, what path of study do you suggest for a foreigner who wants to become a nurse in an English-speaking country?
I truly believe that the individual has to make that personal decision whether they would want to study in their own country over here. Now, with that said, if an individual studies, say, in Spain, for example, or in Nigeria, or whatever country it is, for them to become a nurse, a licensed nurse here, they still have to take the board exam. So, you know, my response is really they have to make that personal decision as to where they would want to get their degree from.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
I'm Alice Bryant.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. From birth to death, the word kick plays an important part in the human experience. In the very beginning, a happy mother-to-be feels the first signs of life kicking inside her. And near the end of life, some people may use the idiom to kick the bucket when someone dies. although I would be careful using it. Kicked the bucket is a very informal slang expression, and it is a bit, well, cold or unfeeling.
That's right. But in addition to those two sayings, American English has many other kick expressions. For example, we kick with our feet, so it should come as no surprise that kicks is a term for shoes. We always use this slang expression in its plural form. Younger people, under the age of 30, use the term kicks more than older people. And they usually use it when talking about a pair of sports shoes, as we will hear in this dialogue.
Hey, I like your kicks. Are those the new Air Jordans?
They are. And I paid a pretty penny for them.
Well, you had better not waste all that money. Let's go shoot some hoops.
Are you crazy? I don't want to damage my brand new kicks.
But they are basketball shoes, made for playing basketball.
But that's not why I bought them. These kicks are for styling.
Now, people of any age kick up their heels when they want to have fun. If you kick up your heels, you have forgotten all about your cares and are having a good time. Kicking up your heels is fun, but getting kicked around is not. That is when people treat you badly. They do not hurt you physically, but they do not treat you with respect or kindness. But pay attention when you hear this expression. Kicking around has other meanings.
It can describe someone who has moved around a lot. People who have kicked around for most of their lives have spent their lives moving from one place to another. If a man spent his 20s and early 30s kicking around from place to place, that means he moved a lot. Besides kicking around from place to place, you can also kick around an idea. This means to have an idea and then think about it in many different ways. You want to know if the idea will work. At an office meeting, workers kicked around ideas on how to improve their delivery process.
So you can kick around an idea, but you can also kick other things, like yourself. To kick yourself means you feel badly about something you did. Usually, this mistake or bad choice made you miss an opportunity, and that is why you are angry and willing to kick yourself. As you can see, kick is one of those English words that has many different meanings depending on the words used with it. For example, if you combine kick with the word off, it means to start something.
Yes, sometimes singers kick off a world tour with one special concert. Or a new store may kick off a grand opening with a great sale event. You can also kickstart something, like your career. It means to get it going. This term comes from motorcycles. On a motorcycle, you must kick down on a metal bar to start the engine. That is where the fundraiser organization, Kickstarter, took its name. With Kickstarter, people give money to kickstart a cause or project.
But without the words off and start, the verb kick means to stop doing something. When you kick something, you stop doing something harmful, like smoking. You can also kick the sugar habit or kick a gossiping habit. We usually say kick the habit together. And now let's change the preposition from off to out. When you kick someone out of a place or group, you ask them to leave. For example, some students are kicked out of school for behaving badly over and over again.
That might be true, but getting a kick out of something is a good thing. This means you really enjoyed it. For example, some people get a kick out of seeing their old friends from high school.
And I can say I always get a kick out of watching fireworks. I really enjoy them. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol, it doesn't move me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that I get a kick out of you? Some like the bop.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. History is full of examples of leaders joining together to meet common goals. But rarely have two leaders worked together with as much friendship and cooperation as Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill did. Roosevelt was President of the United States. Churchill was Prime Minister of Britain. The two men had much in common. They were both born to wealthy families, and they were both active in politics for many years. Both leaders also shared a love of history and nature and the sea. Roosevelt and Churchill first met when they were lower-level officials during World War I, but neither man remembered much about that meeting. However, as they worked together during the Second World War, they came to like and trust each other. Roosevelt and Churchill exchanged more than 1,700 letters and messages over a period of 5.5 years. They met many times at large international gatherings and in private talks. But the closeness of their friendship might be seen best in a story told by one of Roosevelt's close advisors, Harry Hopkins. Hopkins remembered how Churchill was visiting Roosevelt at the White House one day. Roosevelt went into Churchill's room in the morning to say hello, but the president was shocked to see Churchill coming from the bathroom with no clothes on. Roosevelt immediately apologized to the British leader, but Churchill reportedly answered, "The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States." The United States and Great Britain were the most powerful of the nations that joined together as allies to resist Germany's Adolf Hitler and his Axis partners. In January of 1942, 26 of the Allied nations signed an agreement promising to fight for the goals of peace, religious freedom, human rights, and justice. The three major allies were the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union. The governments in Washington and London did not always agree. For example, they disagreed about when to attack Hitler's forces in Western Europe. And Churchill resisted Roosevelt's suggestions that Britain give up some of its colonies. But in general, the friendship between Roosevelt and Churchill, and between the United States and Britain, led the two nations to cooperate closely. This was not true with the Soviets. The Soviet Union was a communist country. It did not share the same history or political system as the United States or Britain. And the Soviet Union had its own interests to protect along its borders and in other areas. Relations between the Soviet Union and the Western Allies were mixed.
On the one hand, Hitler's invasion deep into the Soviet Union had forced Joseph Stalin and other Soviet leaders to make victory over the Germans their most important goal. On the other hand, shadows of future problems could already be seen. The Soviet Union was making clear its desire to keep political control over Poland, and it was supporting communist fighters in Yugoslavia and Greece. These differences were not discussed much, as the foreign ministers of Britain, the Soviet Union, and the United States gathered in Moscow in 1943. Instead, they reached several agreements, including on a plan to establish a new organization called the United Nations. Finally, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin met together for the first time. They met in Tehran in late 1943, mainly to discuss the military situation. However, the three leaders also considered political questions, such as the future of Germany, Eastern Europe, and East Asia. Later, the Allies made further plans for the new United Nations. They arranged for new international economic organizations, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And the Allies agreed to divide Germany into different parts after the war for a temporary period. The Soviet Union would occupy the eastern part, while Britain, France, and the United States would occupy the west. Washington, London, and Moscow were united during the early years of the war because of military need. They knew they must fight together to defeat their common enemy. But this unity faded as Allied troops marched toward the German border. Roosevelt continued to call on the world to wait until the last bullet was fired before deciding what would come next. But Churchill, Stalin, and other leaders already were trying to shape the world that would follow the war. Now differences between the Allies became more serious. The most important question was Poland. Hitler's invasion of Poland in 1939 had started the war. Roosevelt and Churchill believed strongly that the Polish people should have the right to choose their own leaders after the war. Churchill supported a group of Polish resistance leaders who had an office in London. In 1940, Polish flyers had taken part in the Battle of Britain, piloting British warplanes against the German Luftwaffe. But Stalin had other ideas. He demanded that Poland's border be changed to give more land to the Soviet Union, and he refused to help the Polish resistance leaders in London. Instead, he supported a group of Polish communists and helped them establish a new government in Poland. Churchill visited Stalin late in 1944. The two leaders met with Roosevelt a few months later in Yalta on the Crimean coast. All agreed that free elections should be held quickly in Poland, and they traded ideas about the future of Eastern Europe, China, and other areas of the world. Roosevelt was in good spirits when he reported to Congress after his return from the Yalta conference.
I come from the Crimea conference with a firm belief that we have made a good start on the road to a world of peace. There were two main purposes in this Crimea conference. The first was to bring defeat to Germany with the greatest possible speed, with the smallest possible loss of Allied men. That purpose is now being carried out in great force. The German army and the German people are feeling the ever-increasing might of our fighting men and of the Allied armies, and every hour gives us added pride in the heroic advance of our troops in Germany, on German soil, toward a meeting with the gallant Red Army. The second purpose was to continue to build the foundation for an international accord that would bring order and security after the chaos of the war. It would give some assurance of lasting peace among nations of the world. That goal, too, in that goal, toward that goal, a tremendous stride was made.
Roosevelt went on to say that the peace cannot be a completely perfect system at first, but it can be a peace based on the idea of freedom. Churchill had the same high hopes. He told the British Parliament after the conference that Stalin and other Soviet leaders wished to live in honorable friendship. "I also know that their word is honest," Churchill said. But as history proved, Roosevelt and Churchill were wrong about the Soviets. In the months after the Yalta Conference, relations between Moscow and the Western democracies grew steadily worse. The Soviet Union moved to seize control of Eastern Europe. Stalin began making strong speeches, charging that Washington and London were holding secret peace negotiations with Germany. And the Soviet Union refused to discuss ways to bring democracy to Poland. Churchill wrote later that he had always held the Russian people in high honor, but their shadow darkened the picture after the war. Britain and America had gone to war not just to defend the smaller countries, but also to fight for individual rights and freedoms. Churchill went on to say that the Soviet Union had other goals. Its hold tightened on Eastern Europe after the Soviet army gained control. And Churchill said that after the long suffering and efforts of World War II, it seemed that half of Europe had just exchanged one dictator for another. Churchill and Roosevelt agreed in secret letters that they must try to oppose the Soviet effort. But before they could act, Roosevelt died. And the world began to live through a new war, the Cold War, in the years to follow. Roosevelt's death, from bleeding in the brain, also ended a deep personal friendship between two world leaders. Winston Churchill later wrote about hearing the news of the death of his close friend. "I felt as if I had been struck with a physical blow," Churchill wrote. He said he was overpowered by a sense of deep and permanent loss. The free world joined Churchill in mourning the loss of so strong a leader as Franklin Roosevelt. But it could not weep for long. War was giving way to peace. A new world was forming. And as we will hear in future programs, it was a world that few people expected.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.